as we get ready to start our study in what is arguably, in some ways, a rather daunting and somewhat strange book to many of us, because of, first of all, quite frankly, many who are Christians don't read that much of the Old Testament. And when we start looking at the book of Job and dealing with and looking at and seeing some of the questions that are asked, sometimes we get rather uncomfortable with those questions, and we wonder if we should even be dealing with them and asking those kinds of things. I hear all the time, and I'm sure that some of you do as well, we should never ask God any questions. We should never question anything that happens, anything that God does, or whether we wonder whether God does it or not. We should never even ask questions of the Bible. And then we come to the book of Job, and we find that it is a book that raises all sorts of questions. And so we sometimes get uncomfortable with that. But I hope that in our brief time that we have over the next several weeks, that perhaps we'll get over a little of that discomfort and really get to know more and more about not only ourselves, but more and more about God and the world in which we live as we seek to do that. As we begin, don't want to spend a long time with this, but as we begin, a suffering world. Ooh, almost ran out of room. Plan ahead. A suffering world. Anyone who doesn't think that we live in a suffering world, what are some of the signs of suffering or some of the things that you see in the world that cause pain and suffering? Hunger. Child abuse. Poverty. Okay. Healthcare issues. Lack of healthcare. Ed, I missed that one.
I said death, but that would probably last.
Well, but death does tend to cause suffering in the world. And sometimes not just suffering for the folks who have lost a loved one, but depending on what has happened, how it has happened, where it's happened, if it's in conflict or otherwise, it can create even more problems of suffering in the world with retaliation and all kinds of things going on. Wars.
I guess you get not just limited to child abuse because there's so much just general abuse, period. I guess you could just label abuse.
Well, child abuse slash...
Yeah, sexual, spousal.
Yeah, you got spousal, sexual, geriatric.
Yes.
Abuse in nursing homes, all kinds of places.
A lot of people seem to be in this area is lack of jobs.
Okay. Unemployment. And not just, well, we won't say just illegal drugs, but the illegal use of drugs. Because people abuse legal drugs a lot, too. Prejudging, prejudice. You got, there are folks who are in physical pain almost constantly, and then you got the mental anguish and pain for a variety of reasons. So there are a lot of things out there, and we could go on, we could spend the whole time we're here this evening probably just thinking of and listing things that cause pain and suffering, or are the results, pain and suffering are the results of those kinds of things. So why?
One of the things that we didn't list, and that is, and I'm hearing those in a lot of places, is teen pregnancy. I mean, that's just because it really hits not just the person or the two people or the child, but the family.
Well, yeah, teen pregnancy, but then again, it's not just teen pregnancy, but people turn on the television, they look at the entertainment shows, and such a couple who have just been dating for several years, but you know they're adults, and they announce that they're having a child, you know, and that kind of thing. So,
well, that could be brought down and put under one thing, ignorance.
There's a lot of ignorance out there, and ignorance does cause a lot of pain and suffering. All kinds of ignorance, and that's. So we admit and we agree that we live in a world that is full of pain and suffering, and that needs some word of hope and some change, which could lead us to ask other questions. Why is there suffering? Some is ignorance, some is selfishness, all kinds of things. Why do the innocent suffer? Is God responsible? Who is responsible?
God gives a lot of credit for a lot of things He's not responsible for.
That's true. God and the devil get a whole lot of credit for stuff that they don't do because we don't want to take credit for what we've done wrong or what somebody else has done. And does everything happen for a planned reason? You know, we say everything happens for a reason, but do we really hold to that deep down inside, or is that sometimes a cop-out for us because we don't understand and we don't want to think that maybe we won't understand, and so everything happens for a reason? These are some similar questions to what are raised by Job and even some of his friends in the book of Job. You know, when we think of Job, most often the word that comes to mind, we said last week, was patience. Yet Job's story is really not as much about patience as it is about theology. And your lesson writer, your book writer, will state that. How one seeks to understand God and God's ways. It's a story in which the author wants to know why God acts as God does. You know, most of us, at some point in time, if we admit it, we have asked why. Though often quickly, depending on what it is. Often, we quickly and almost apologetically make a statement about, oh, but I'm not questioning God. Or, why? Oh, but the Lord works in mysterious ways and we shouldn't question. After all, God makes no mistakes. God may not make mistakes, but sometimes we do. And sometimes mistakes happen in spite of our best efforts or because of our best efforts. But these are all questions that are raised in living life in a suffering world. Now, I'm not suggesting that God is making mistakes. But I am saying, can we not ask questions? And can we not even ask questions of God in our search to try and understand? If we can't, then the real question is, God really God? Is God unable to deal with our human questions out of our human lives and our lack of understanding? If not, then by definition, that should kind of preclude God being truly God. How many times have we felt like Job? Now, while we might not be as righteous as the text says Job was, although many of us may be very righteous, we have all suffered loss. We've all suffered through tragedies, through disappointments in life. Anybody that's not been disappointed at some point? And I'm not just talking about Santa Claus didn't bring you the weenie whistle or the mystery date game. If you watch Santa Claus, you know, the Santa Claus with Tim Allen, you'd know. But did we not ever feel disappointed because we didn't get something we thought we deserved? Or maybe disappointed because we got something we didn't think we should get? I didn't deserve that, we say. When somebody snaps at us or when something bad happens, wait a minute, I didn't deserve that. Sometimes we ask if there's any justice in the world. Have you ever asked that? Perhaps like Job, we wondered about trusting God or asked why God allows uncertainty to enter our lives, much less something that seems evil. Raising those questions. Job's suffering raises those questions. And sometimes we can kind of get around the issue by putting it off on Job and not admitting that we have the same questions and the same issues. And sometimes we aren't seeming to get answers. Have you ever thought, you know, Lord, I've been praying and praying and praying, but I'm not hearing anything. Are you still out there? Are you listening? You know, many times preachers avoid much of the book of Job. And I'll tell you why. Because easy answers are not found in this book. There are no easy answers in this book. And a lot of folks want easy answers. And quite frankly, a lot of ministers out there are afraid to say they don't know something or they don't understand something. And so they avoid the book. But sometimes I think we need to face the questions and the uncertainty. That's the price we pay to seek wisdom. And Tony Cartledge, the author of the book, says that. The price we pay to really get to know God is to face the questions and the uncertainties and to face them head on and ask. Tony Cartledge writes in another article, sometimes we learn that there are no answers or that we've been asking the wrong questions. And that's frustrating. But I would add, how can we learn and grow if we avoid the questions that come up in the journey? Now, the book of Job is part of a larger tradition of literature called what? That's right, wisdom literature. A larger tradition of what's called wisdom literature, which was a common type of literature in the Near East, or what we call the Middle East. Like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and other books, some of which are found in the Apocrypha. Wisdom literature takes all kinds of forms. You can find Proverbs, you can find riddles, you can find practical advice, you might find deep philosophical questions being asked, and Job asks a lot of those deep questions. For example, in ancient Sumer, the Sumerians, another ancient people, actually in the land somewhere around 3500 BC or so, the Sumerians had schools that they called the Tablet House, where all lessons would be written down on clay tablets. And one riddle from ancient Sumer, talking about wisdom literature, that talks about the importance and the value of education, says, a house with a foundation like heaven, a house which like a vessel has been covered with linen, a house which like a goose stands on a firm base. One with eyes not opened has entered it, one with open eyes has come out of it. The answer to the riddle, it is the school. And so you find those kinds of things even in wisdom literature. The two most recognized books of wisdom in the Bible that we regularly think about are Proverbs. Job is one, but most of the time we think of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. That's right. Those two books as wisdom literature. Job is another that is in that genre. Job is also a great epic poem. It is poetry, which sometimes makes it all the more difficult to understand because there are very few prose sections in the book of Job. The first few chapters and the last few chapters are prose. Everything else is in poetry. And I was almost tempted to get our resident English expert to talk to us about poetry and how difficult sometimes it is to really understand poetry. But I decided not to put her on the spot. Actually, yes, I had thought about doing it kind of spur of the moment, too, which would really... No. But the people of Israel composed a number of wisdom texts in the forms of proverbs that were handed down father to son in maxims that were meant for living a prudent life. But not all wisdom found in Proverbs works out. Think of something. No pain, no gain. We speak of that. No pain, no gain, right? Especially football coaches. No pain, no gain. But is that always true? No. Think about, for example, the person that's born with the silver spoon in their mouth that inherits all the money and all the wealth and doesn't have to work for it. No pain, no gain doesn't work for them. Or Ben Franklin's claim, early to bed, early to rise. One makes one healthy, wealthy, and wise. Now that might work for some, but if you look into the ancient world, even if you look into our country's history, slaves in many eras were forced to get up early and work long hours, but they rarely gained from their labor.
They gained more than they realized.
They did, but they rarely gained what they had hoped and what they could have if you looked at Franklin's. Job and Ecclesiastes are in the area of speculation, though. That type of wisdom where you speculate, recognizing that reality is not easily categorized as we'd like for it to be. Trust me, I'd much rather things be a whole lot easier cut and dried. But the longer I live and the more I deal with life and the more I deal with the biblical text, the fewer black and white areas I find that a whole lot of gray. I'm not just talking about my hair. There's a whole lot of gray. But these books also raise questions about simple teachings of tradition as well. When we look at these texts, we will find that some of the traditionalists are Job's friends that come in with the old traditions and say, you know, well, no, if you just do this or if you just say that, then everything will be fine. And the book of Job and Job himself in this book raise questions about sometimes the traditional answer is not always the best answer. Now, there are similar texts not only in Sumerian, one entitled A Man and His God, in which an unfortunate man complains he's lost everything and his God is indifferent. But unlike Job, he accepts the advice of the sages that he's suffering because of sin. Job doesn't accept that. And most traditional wisdom in the ancient Middle East, Near East, you're suffering because either you have committed a sin or your mama and daddy committed a sin or your grandparents committed a sin. Even in the Hebrew text, in the Old Testament, it says even to the 10th generation, certain sins are punished. So you get to Jeremiah who says, no, you have to answer for your own. Or a Babylonian poem, I Will Praise the Lord of Wisdom, speaks of the sufferings of a nobleman who ultimately is delivered by the Babylonian god Marduk, who is praised as the Lord of Wisdom. In Egyptian wisdom literature, The protest of the eloquent peasant recounts the complaints of a man that's victimized by a crooked official. I know we don't have crooked officials these days. He's victimized by a crooked official, thereby raising questions about justice and injustice. The wisdom literature of Israel reflects influences from other cultures that they've had contact with, but we also need to remember that Job is not an Israelite, but he is from the land of Uz. Not Oz. Uz. Now, while most Protestant Bibles contain only three books of wisdom literature, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes, the Bible used by Roman Catholics, by Episcopalians, by the early King James Version, by our own altar Bible, contain the Apocrypha, which contains other books of wisdom, two in particular: the Wisdom of Solomon and something called Ecclesiasticus, or the Wisdom of Jesus ben Sirach, that is, Jesus son of Sirach. But wisdom traditions are also found in Psalm 1, Psalm 19, Psalm 37, Psalm 73, and Psalm 119, and in some of the prophets, such as in Jeremiah chapter 17. Now, the Hebrew word for wisdom ranges in meaning from the skill of a craftsman or an artist, to a soldier's skill and cunning, to a philosopher. And so wisdom can be many different things to many different people. Proverbs is filled with practical wisdom needed to be successful in daily living. In the Psalms and the prophets, we find more traditional beliefs that obedience to God results in material success and in blessing. As Tony Cartledge writes, though Israel's sages knew that traditional wisdom didn't always work, could not always be guaranteed. Hard work should lead to prosperity, but circumstances could interrupt that. Righteous living should lead to God's blessing, but those who paid attention knew that sometimes the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. You ever wonder about that? Why the good suffer and the evil get ahead sometimes? Job dares to challenge those conventional traditions. And that's why Job, the book of Job, if we really sit down and read it through carefully, that's why the book of Job sometimes bothers us. Because Job doesn't settle for the traditional wisdom, but rather looks more deeply into the mystery and asks the hard questions. Now, Job is set in the ancient past before Israel ever existed. It reflects all kinds of ancient traditions, but probably did not come into its final form until the post-exilic period, as Cartledge writes in your text. That is the Persian period. The exilic period was Babylon, the exile. Pre-exilic was the kingdom of Assyria, who conquered Israel. Post-exilic is the Persian. And in the Persian era is where the Persians came in and conquered the Babylonians and then told the Hebrews, if you want to go back and rebuild your towns, rebuild your temple, worship your God, that's perfectly okay. And it's in the Persian period that we find in Ezra and Nehemiah the people coming back and starting to rebuild the temple and reestablish the worship of God. But difficult questions were asked by those returning exiles. When some of them returned home and found the terrible shape of Jerusalem, the holy city, they wondered if God had even betrayed them. That's a common human response. Where are you, God? Have you given up on us? Those questions were raised in the Babylonian exile. We're God's chosen people. Nothing like this should happen to us. And then they started saying, well, maybe God doesn't care for us anymore, or maybe God's not powerful in Babylon and only back home. Some of the language incorporated into part of Job, such as Aramaic and Arabic, indicates a late date of development for the text, the finish of the book, but the story is much earlier than even the patriarchs. As I've already said, some of Job is difficult to understand, though not just because of the language, but because it is poetry. The story of Job, this poem, is framed by a prologue, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 13, and an epilogue, chapter 42, verses 7 to 17, that are prose. And what's the story? The story is that of a righteous man. We're told Job is righteous. A righteous man who loses everything. Actually, anybody read this already? And I just want to see, was anybody caught off guard, taken by surprise at the way Tony Cartlidge writes what takes place and raises the question about what happened to Job? What is it the result of?
A wager.
A divine wager. A wager between the Satan, that is the adversary, and God. Not really kind of the way we've often been taught that. I mean, how many of you ever regarded it as, you know, it's a bet. Really? It's a wager between the Satan and God. And by the way, if you've read ahead, you've probably already seen that it's the Satan. At this point in time, he hasn't been kicked out. Which also means that if this is a literal occurrence and he hadn't been kicked out yet, then, and there are already people on the earth, then the serpent in the garden was not the devil, the fallen angel. But he is the Satan. Hasatan. It's not a proper name, though, in our Bibles. It's written that way. He's kind of like, as Cartlidge said, and I've said for a number of years, he's kind of like the heavenly DA. It's his job to go back and forth. He's part of the heavenly court. It's his job to go back and forth on the earth and into the presence of God in heaven to bring indictments against people before God, to look at things that people are doing, and then he brings charges. Only this time, he's been looking around and he sees nothing. I mean, Job's got everything. And he's beginning to wonder. He sees all these other people doing horrible things, some of them even cursing God. And then he starts wondering about this guy, Job. And he says, you know, I wonder what he'd really be like if he lost everything. And he raises that question. And God said, oh, he's righteous. And the Satan said, well, are you willing to put your money where your mouth is? He says, I don't think that'll happen. I think he'll curse you. God said, oh no, I know his heart and he won't. Oh no, I think he will. And so this adversary, the Satan, then begins to work. And God says, okay, you can do this, but not that. And then when he doesn't win the wager, he says, well, but if you do such and such, God says, well, you just can't kill him. You can do all these other things, you just can't kill him. And the adversary was very, very confident. But it raises the questions. And we find a man that, in spite of what he goes through, continues to remain loyal to God. He doesn't understand. And he raises questions. And quite frankly, if you read the book of Job carefully, he does not curse God, but he sure comes awfully close to doing that a couple of times because he's ready to give it up. Yes, Ed. There are a lot of folks that would say it is metaphorical, or this poem is a great epic parable. And really the way Cartledge puts it here, and that's why I asked you, anybody, did that kind of get it, catch anybody's attention, a wager between God and the Satan? I don't think it's so much a bet as we think of betting. But yeah, there are folks that would contend that it's not an actual historical but it's occurrence, but it's a parable. And then there are others, no, it's literally as it reads. So you know, that is a way to look at that and see, because God betting on, I don't think that's the case. And yet, is it not also another, some folks look at it not so much as a wager as a defense. God's defending this person whose heart He knows. But in order, you know, some people, I guess in this case, if the United States existed, I guess he probably, the Satan probably would have been from Missouri. Show me. You know, the show me state. Okay, prove it to me. Show me. But the core of the book is a series of conversations between Job and three friends. And sometimes you look at those friends and what comes to mind? With friends like these? That's right. Don't need enemies. Who needs enemies? And speeches by Job. There is an ode to wisdom that is in here, and kind of a one-sided conversation between God and Job, in which God does most of the speaking. Many of the conversations between Job and Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, as well as that conversation with God later in the text, challenge traditional theology that's found in the prologue. The main characters, except God and the Satan, don't know why the suffering happens, though Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are quick to tell Job, "We know why, and you just need to admit your sin." They presume Job has committed a secret sin. He's trying to hide it from everybody. So in the book of Job, there's tension. There is tension about suffering and why. But in chapters 38 through 41, God gives a self-revelation that calls attention to His greatness, which leads Job to repent of his ignorance, not his sin. Theology in the book of Job depends on an understanding of God as a creative God with power and with purpose. And while not a Jew, Job worships God and observes many of the customs of the later Hebrews. The book does raise questions about the traditional beliefs that one must simply live in obedience to God to be blessed, because here Job has lived in obedience to God and he's anything but blessed on the surface. Sin and rebellion are supposed to result in punishment and destruction, not following God and being obedient. But in the book of Job, we notice life isn't always that simple, is it? Or perhaps not just in the book of Job, perhaps in our own lives, we find that life isn't always that simple. Sometimes the righteous suffer even at the hands of the wicked. Some people try to defend traditional views of God by saying that blessing will eventually come to the righteous in God's time. But sometimes that also seems like a lame excuse. The book of Job asks the hard questions of innocent suffering and failed promises and doesn't come to firm answers. God offers an assurance of His presence even in times and places of darkness and uncertainty. And we find the presence of an unfettered and untamed God here. And Cartledge will say that. He said, what we find here is a God that cannot be tamed. How often? Think about it. How often do we, as church people, how often do followers of God, and not just followers of God in Christ, but even within Judaism, how often do we seek to really tame God in the way we describe God and the ways we think of God? In the book of Job, we have an untamed God. We have a God who has power, who creates, and who will not fit into human created boxes. Tony does write. God does not, cannot, and will not fit into human created boxes. Rather, our boxes may actually hide God's greatness from us. We need to learn to trust a God who is wild and free, yet loving and kind. A God who is beyond our very dreams. And that's the God we find in the book of Job. One that cannot be boxed in by what we think God ought to be, but who is God beyond our limited understanding, beyond our limited attempts at trying to box God in. Now, if you want to read more than what we are going to be able to study, and I highly suggest it, read through the entire book of Job. Your textbook gives you a basic outline of what to expect in each section. As you know, we will only be able to deal with certain sections in the time that we have together. And that in itself will raise enough questions, probably, to last us for a long time. And yet, it is in those questions that are asked by Job and the ensuing attempts by well-meaning friends, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, and the one time Job's wife speaks and says, just go ahead and curse God and die, that we find the real journey to understanding more about who God is and allowing ourselves to be open to God even more, even in our suffering and uncertainty, than perhaps we have ever allowed ourselves before. But I will tell you, the times that I've read much of the book of Job, I've gotten uncomfortable, and I'm not so sure sometimes that I want to let go. And that's one of the challenges that I think we will find in looking at Job, that sometimes we have to go into the fire and we have to ask the hard questions and we have to do the deep searching, not only of our own souls and spirits, but searching for the things of God, which sometimes we find uncomfortable, before, like the phoenix, we can rise out of the ashes, renewed, reborn, recommitted. And so I hope that you will take the time, may not happen over the next several weeks, but at least maybe even beyond that, to read Job more closely, to not get so bogged down in analyzing the poetry at first blush. In fact, it's probably better sometimes that we read a section and just read that section straight through to see what things may jump out of us at a cursory reading, and then go back and look more closely at what we find. I am not going to promise you that you will be comfortable over the next several weeks. I'm not going to promise you that we're going to find hard and fast answers over the next several weeks. What I will promise you is a place and a time where we can study, where we can read, where we can try and gain some depth of understanding, but where we can also ask our questions that maybe we're not too sure about. And at least journey together in trying to gain understanding. As I have said before on some things, and I will say now, I don't completely understand. I'm always finding new things. I don't guarantee we're going to come up with answers. And I certainly don't guarantee we're going to always get straight answers. But I promise you that we'll work at understanding, and we'll do that together. And so I do welcome your questions. I do welcome your insight. Because, as I said, I am one who will admit I don't know it all. And I want to know it all. So I guess I'll always be working at it. But I hope that we can do that together. And we will next time. This was an intro, but we will move in that first chapter about looking at Job and his affliction as an innocent. Both of his tests and then when his friends first show up. And what do we find out in that about God and about where God is sometimes where we don't even look for Him? And I want you to look at those. You may have already started answering the questions toward the end of your lesson. You may not have. But look at those questions toward the end of your lesson. They are in number one. What does it mean to fear God and turn away from evil? Have you experienced a time when you felt like Job? Have you responded to time? How have you responded to times of loss, pain, and suffering? What events or situations have caused you to ask, why did it happen? Or better yet, have you ever asked, how could God let this happen? We've already talked about who was the Satan. But who was the Satan and why might God accept his dare? See, Cartlidge talks here about it in the question more of a dare than a bet, than a wager. How do you feel about God doing that to test Job's integrity? Do you believe God is inherently worthy of worship, or is your view of God dependent on what God has done for you? In other words, why do you worship God? And that's a question that gets raised in this first section and in this first chapter. Why do you worship God? Why do we worship God? But more specifically, why do you worship God? Is it because God has done something for you? Or are there other reasons to worship God? Why do you think Job's wife encouraged him to curse God and die? That'd be interesting. I'm not going to ask for answers on that unless people want to volunteer. But those would be some interesting answers, probably based in part on gender of who answers. How would you define integrity? What material possessions would you use to keep? If you could keep all your material possessions, your family, and your health, but lack integrity, would that be enough? That's a hard question for a lot of folks to ask, to be really honest. If you could keep all this stuff but give up your integrity in the process, could you look at yourself in the mirror every day when you shaved or washed your face or plucked your eyebrows? Does everything, even tragedy, happen for a reason? And what do you think about that? So I hope you'll look at those questions, that you'll read that section, and I hope that maybe perhaps next time you will be wanting to share insights that you have gotten from your reading, from your questions, from your answers, as we try to look at the book of Job. Into the fire, out of the ashes. So do you all have any questions or anything you'd like to add to our brief introduction this evening? I'll go ahead and wipe this before it gets to the point where you can always read it.
Steve, I think there are two things that we brought tonight to be very important before we start this. Number one, God was really the deception, but He was not the protagonist of this.
Okay. Ken says that God withdrew His protection, but was not the antagonist. Corrected, antagonist in this case.
And secondly, you don't have to sin to be tested. Which is, that's kind of like a Micah commercial. You always say, give it to Micah, he'll heal anything. That's not what the commercial said at all.
No.
The commercial actually said He won't heal anything, but we have misinterpreted that over time. And I think those are probably two of the major things we think about Job. We think God tested Job. He was doing his protection, but he wasn't one, the Satan was the one that went down and actually did the testing, so to speak.
Okay.
Proved out he was tested. But he, God was not the tester.
Okay. God was not the tester, and the other is that you don't have to sin to be tested.
Going back to parables, first of all, there's no acknowledged writer of Job.
No, it's a wisdom writer, and actually, some of the writing of Job is probably fairly early, but the final format comes about later. Yes. Yeah, more parabolic, and there are a number of books that have some passages like that, and in the Apocrypha there are several books, while they're not classified as wisdom literature, but that are more in that line of a parable, and the moral of the story is kind of thing. Parable and a paradox can be interpreted more than one way and have significant meaning. I'm repeating that for the sake of the DVD. Maybe we need to set microphones up everywhere. And you at microphone number two.
One of the things that you run into a lot, especially with people who are actually questioning religious beliefs, it's a lot which can't be answered. And that, you mentioned that while earlier, you can't answer the question. And yet, if you're trying to talk to someone about your religious beliefs, and they ask a question that can't be answered, then they say, ah, so yeah, you can't answer that.
Yeah, some people try to use that to trap you. And we get uncomfortable with not being able to answer the questions. And we try so hard to answer them that sometimes we, if we really sat back and thought of what we said, we'd say, did I really say that? But it's kind of like, and with that in mind, said not too long ago here, I believe, and we were chatting about something one evening. And a lot of times, especially believers, we say people who are Christian and then get asked the hard questions by somebody who's not, whether they're agnostic or atheistic or some other religion, we say, well, we're believers and they're non-believers. Well, no, we're actually both believers. It's just we believe one thing and they believe something else. And the fact that they have asked us the question puts us on the defensive and oftentimes allows the other person to feel like they're off the hook. Ah, I've got him. But you can turn the question around, okay? You prove such and such. Well, but you prove that it's not. You know, you believe that it's not. I believe that it is. Okay, I can make attempts to convince you that it is. That may or may not prove it to you, but you also need to step up to the plate and give me proof that your position. And that then takes us out of the defensive. We who say that we are followers of a particular, that can kind of lessen some of the defensive nature and maybe even open us to more possibilities of understanding. Because when we get defensive, we immediately start shutting some things out. Things start shutting down. And people say, as you were saying, say, I see you can't answer. You know, they put us on a defensive and they think they're off the hook. So sometimes the terminology may need to be a little bit different. You know, recognizing we're believers. We believe in, they believe not, but they still believe.
It's a good question. And you offer to them, and sometimes the only answer you have is, I live by faith.
But sometimes, when they ask you and you say, well, I live by faith, and that's the only answer you can come up with, a lot of times they'll kind of say, they'll deride you and they'll say, see, I got you. Because part of the reason is they're, quite frankly, in most instances, if you got them to sit down and really admit to themselves, much less to you, they're not that sure about it either. And sometimes what folks like that are trying to do is see if you do have something that's going to give them even a sense of hope to their hopelessness. And some are just mean and cantankerous too. But sometimes Christians can be mean and cantankerous. But I think, you know, there's a difference in having a set of beliefs and in having faith. And when you say, I live by faith, then that's really what faith should be, is a combination of belief and the way you live it out. Far too often when people say, well, I have faith or I live by faith, they're not talking about how they truly live about it or live it out. They're just talking about their particular set of beliefs that they have, which they may or may not be able to prove or help folks with. So, you know, I think that Job raises questions that make us uncomfortable. But then again, if we can find some sense of how sometimes we get tossed into the fire, but there is a way to get out, and God's not going to zap us with a lightning bolt and make ashes of us if we ask the questions, then that may also help us in the long run be able to deal in a better way with those other, with other folks that raise the questions, raise the issues, with some sense of a positive. You know, far too often what we want to do is go at them and start pointing fingers and condemning instead of trying to give a positive kind of approach. We try to coerce rather than try to persuade. And I think if we're willing to ask the questions and sometimes admit we don't know, but here's a possibility that seems to work, that persuasion may take them, it takes us off the defensive and may actually lessen some of the pejorative nature of what other people toss out there. It's about having the faith that will search to understand more of God and sometimes admit that God's far beyond our understanding. And sometimes there aren't any easy answers, but we continue to live it even in spite of the difficult answers.
God knew when He took the dare that Job was righteous enough to believe in Him and He would give Him strength to come through.
And that's the thing. God looked to Job, and God knew that Job was righteous. And then we have the story.
Does it explain the difference between Satan and the Satan? I mean, how this is not Satan of the New Testament? Does it go further in detail? Because I was kind of confused.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit in your textbook there, but actually, within reading back into that, it's not the same understanding of Satan from the New Testament or even later Judaism, that some of which read back into Second Temple Judaism, some of that read back into even the Genesis text, that, you know, he had already been cast out by that point in time. But for the writer of Genesis chapter 2 and 3 about the fall, the creation of humanity and the fall, or the man and the woman and the fall, for him there was no idea whatsoever that that was a fallen angel. That was just a cunning creature that God had made that was allowed to participate in man's decision to fall or not. But there is this whole, for much of Judaism and the theology within Judaism, to give to any other entity the ability to create and control something so far-reaching as evil was to give them the status of a creator. And there is a creator, God. To give the devil that, or Satan, that ability is to give him godlike qualities. And then you're not monotheistic anymore. But at this point, this is pre-patriarchal. Abram was the first of the patriarchs. This is pre-patriarchal. And there is not an understanding that, I mean, the understanding is that the Satan, he is the adversary. And when he is cast out, he is our adversary. He is still the adversary. on the earth. But at this point, he's still part of the heavenly court and is free to come and go as he pleases, and has not made that challenge. Now, there are some that would say, oh, well, in the book of Job, you start seeing his challenge, which only grows later, and that's what gets him kicked out. Well, that may or may not be the case, but even if so, at this point, he's still part of the heavenly court.
Technically, it's the same beast.
It would be the same being. It's just a matter of time.
Okay. It doesn't have the same role yet.
No. Okay. No.
Okay.
Good question. Doesn't have the same role yet. Anyone else? Okay. If not, then may you go seeking wisdom, seeking understanding, and being willing to ask the tough questions, because only in that can we find the journey more meaningful and the rewards even greater. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.